Good morning at 7:59. This is KBOO Portland, and Linda Olson Osterlund is the host of Voices from the Edge, and she is going to speak with author Mike German next. Stay with us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Beauty of the Earth on Saturday, November 16th at 7 p.m. at the Trinity United Methodist Church in Portland. Beauty on Earth is the fall concert presented by the Portland Peace Choir. This is also the first performance with the new choir director, Jesse Cromer. There will also be a raffle, baked goods, and more. Again, that's Beauty of the Earth on Saturday, November 16th at 7 p.m. at the Trinity United Methodist Church, 3915 Southeast Steele Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The events committee meets the third Monday of every month at 5 o'clock p.m.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host the screening of Can You Dig This? On Thursday, November 14th, at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater.
To change the community, you have to change the composition of the soil. We are the soil.
If this plant can die and it grows back in a bad environment in a city like this, then for sure I know I can fall and get back up and do the same thing.
I put a carrot in the ground and all hell broke loose.
Again, that's Can You Dig This? On Thursday, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio and to Voices from the Edge. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund, your host today. I'm really excited. We've got a great guest today. We had him on in September. I got a chance to interview him about a recent article of his. This is Mike German. He's formerly of the FBI, and you may have heard him or met him if you're activists out there in the audience when he came to speak against the Portland staying in the JTTF. So let me tell you a little bit more about him. He was a longtime counterterrorism undercover agent for the FBI. He's also a fellow of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brenner Center School of Law, and he has worked at the ACLU as well. He's also the author of his first book, Thinking Like a Terrorist, and then his current book, which I'm very excited, has just come out. It's called Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy. Welcome to KBOO, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
And I hope it's okay to call you Mike throughout the interview rather than
Absolutely.
Have me switch to Mr. German now and then.
Yeah, no worries.
All right, thank you. Well, you know, I got your electronic copy of your book 2 days ago, and so I have been speeding through it. I found it actually very readable, and I'll say, having covered this kind of subject in public affairs for over 10 years now, sometimes the new books that come out are a little bit boring to me. They're just a recount of some stuff you need and with a little different angle on it, and aren't, you know, they somehow seem to just be restating from an angle that author has a point of view on. But I found your book Very, very informative, even though much of the events that you talk about that the FBI have been involved with are events that I've read about and have some knowledge about. There was a whole lot of new knowledge I gained from your book as well, and I really appreciated the way that you presented it. And I felt by the end of the book that, that boy, if I was the FBI, I wouldn't want your book out. That's what I really thought. I thought, I thought if I was Mueller, I would hope nobody read what you have to say about him, because it's not like you're mean, but you're truthful. And I learned a lot of facts about Mueller that I didn't know. I did know about him covering up the knowledge that Colleen Rowley had tried to bring to the attention of leadership in the FBI just before 9/11, that there was somebody who was training to fly a jet and seemed to be a terrorist, and the upper echelons flubbed that. And then when Mueller took over, he wasn't the one who had flubbed it, but he basically told her, shut up and don't say it, don't tell anybody about it. And so I knew that much about him, but I didn't know a lot more. And we don't have to get fully into Mueller right now.
Right.
But I would like you to say a little bit, because it's got to be things like that, about how you came to decide to write this book, which really, I'm sure there are FBI agents who are applauding you for having done this. I'm certain of that. But I'm certain there are many more who are really like, whoa, he's bad.
So one of the things that I wanted to do was to make sure that I was talking to a lot of agents and telling their stories. This isn't just a story about me and my experience. You know, I wanted to make sure that not only was I covering the many different stories of different kinds of abuses and problems within the FBI, but that, you know, the FBI is made up of people, and unfortunately the manner in which the FBI often looks at the world and makes generalizations, they do that internally as well. So there are a number of agents who, because of their race or their religion, or like Colleen Rowley, just because they were pointing out problems within the FBI, would get targeted for various kinds of reprisals, and it's very debilitating. I mean,
you point a picture of how it turns inward on itself to point blame, and rather than take responsibility, and in many occasions scapegoating agents of color, taking them out of areas where they're making huge contributions and putting them into areas where they can make almost no contribution. Just doing many things that drove, so that driving diversity out of the forces of the FBI in the policies and ways that they handle internally. But you say in your book, one of the things I think that's really important about your book is you talk about the radicalization theory that they've been operating under since 9/11. And I can even remember one bill that they tried to get traction on to pass about radicalization and self-radicalization. It was an attempt to get into more control over the internet early after 9/11. Can you kind of introduce us to that theory and the beginning of use of that, and what you saw about that and how that was such a problem? And you came in, I should say, you came into the FBI around the beginning of Clinton, right?
Actually, even before that, in 1988 is when I joined the FBI. And it was interesting, and then started worked my first terrorism case against neo-Nazis in 1992, so right at the beginning of the Clinton administration. And it was fascinating because in the 80s and 90s, there were two schools of terrorism research, one that was led mostly by psychologists who tried to argue there was some kind of psychological defect, and their goal was to do enough research to find that defect, and that way the person could be identified and treated before they did something bad. And the other school was mostly political scientists who talked about terrorism as just one form of political violence in a larger system, and that you couldn't understand why a group would, or an individual would, engage in violence against the state unless you understood how that state operated. And looked at terrorism in context with other political violence, including state violence. And those schools often opposed one another, but by the time I was working these cases in the 1990s, enough research had been done to indicate there wasn't a mental defect. That in fact,
you know, that kind of research at all was really after the Nazis, eugenics, and all of that, to try to pin down a defect in a person or a race of people or a grouping of people, and then use that they're somehow lesser than. That's
right.
A pretty scary direction right. They were heading that in, huh?
Right, and by the time it got to when I was working these cases, they had pretty much dismissed the psychological defect theory. They
yes.
said, you know, we've done enough research now, there's no psychological defect, these are people making rational choices. And so after 9/11, when I saw them resurrect this language of radicalization, you know, this was a theory that J. Edgar Hoover used in the early 1900s to target labor organizers and immigrants and people of color. And basically what it alleges is that the people who commit political violence aren't the problem, it's the people who spread the ideas that cause people to then go commit violence, and that the only way to stop the violence is to suppress the ideas. And
well, you know what's interesting about that is that you probably know this just because you're wide read, but Lenin has a book out. Lenin, not now. The book is probably still in print, but Lenin of Marx and Lenin of the early 20th century, he had a book out called What is to Be Done? And fundamentally, the answer in that book was seize power, create public opinion. So very much a precursor of if you had the hands of media and the ability to speak to people, you could change their opinion. Seems like it's
right.
very much the same kind of thing, control what's being expressed.
Right. And the state likes the radicalization theory because basically what it would argue is anybody who is opposing government policy is radicalized, and that doesn't mean necessarily they're violent, but that they could become violent, so they're worthy of suppression. And that suppression comes through mass surveillance, it comes through targeted selective prosecution, it comes through all kinds of different means. And so when I saw that language being resurrected after 9/11, specifically in reference to Muslim terrorists and Muslim people writ large, I knew that was going to be a problem, because it was basically taking that psychological defect theory and breathing new air into it without the scientific analysis, right? Where psychologists and psychiatrists actually have diagnoses that they make that can be proven or disproven, where whether somebody is, quote, radical is all in the eyes of the beholder. And it's a useful theory for the government to then target large populations of people rather than focusing on the much smaller number of people who would actually commit crimes.
Well, and they also seem to think that people could be exposed to ideas and language and change just from that, as if it's not something, as if that language isn't speaking to something in their own lives that might inspire them to some form of action. It's really breaking
right.
people into these.
No truth in it.
It's really just not holistically human. It's like the FBI is behind the times in looking at a whole human being, you know. That,
right. And that was part of the frustration for me as an FBI agent who was trained to look at evidence and deduce facts, to see them use a theory that had been wholly discredited. And it's fascinating because in the last 18 years, 19 years that this has been part of the discussion, they'll acknowledge that there's no scientific basis for this theory. And yet it's useful to their targeting methods, so they use it. But basically what it does is say that anybody from entire groups of people are dangerous and worthy of suspicion, and that That's why we have these very elaborate sting operations now, because they believe if somebody has expressed these ideas, they're on the pathway to becoming a terrorist, so there's no point in waiting for them to become a terrorist. We'll just send people out to recruit them into a fake terrorist organization, and that's a useful use of security resources, when of course there's no evidence that that person ever would have done something wrong absent the government coming in and encouraging them.
Well, and Mike, you wrote about in your book about one example of that, the famous or infamous attempt to bomb the Christmas tree down in the square. But it, you know, that was exactly what you said. It was like a reverse sting, and they did everything to put this person in a position to and give them the weapons to be able to carry out something that all on their own would not have been able to be done. And those kind of tactics, it's interesting to me because this radicalization theory reminds me of other, you know, like some of the ways that they want to do surveillance. So when they first look at one person, they've targeted them for something they've done or heard or whatever. Then they look at everyone they've been in contact and they spread out the surveillance to those. And then they look at, because they assume that if you've heard this message and you're in that sort of grouping, then you're going to carry it out. It's pretty scary, and it pretty much means that all of us at any point, you know, it's that 6 degrees of separation. I know in the gang task force here in Portland, you know, if you're a young black man and you know another young black man that might have somehow got on the gang enforcement list, you're on the list. It doesn't matter what you do or how you've behaved. It's the same kind of policing.
Right, and in combination with the resurrection of this radicalization theory, the Justice Department also lowered the standards by which FBI agents are allowed to begin investigations. So when I was working in the 80s, we had a standard of a reasonable indication of criminal activity. So I had to have some objective, factual basis to believe somebody was actually breaking the law or would break the law before I could investigate them. And I found that to be very useful, because like in my undercover case with neo-Nazis, everybody was saying something that I didn't like and that frightened me and that sounded dangerous to me. But I was required to have the discipline of coming back to the office and writing down the objective facts I believed about each individual, whether there was evidence to believe they were breaking the law. And that helped me focus my investigations properly on people who were actually breaking the law rather than people who were just expressing themselves. So when those standards were lowered to originally just requiring information or an allegation to conduct a long-term investigation, but eventually by 2008, it took away the requirement for a predicate at all. So that again opens up the ability for agents to target people based on bias, where just because of who they are or who, as you suggested, who they associate with or the color of their skin or their political ideas, because the agent felt that idea was a threat to the government, they could then conduct quite intrusive investigations under this lowest category of investigation called assessments.
And Mike, do they have access to the other information that would be there through the Fusion Center? I know that the Fusion Centers have, you know, they purchase a lot of data that's being collected commercially. They also have information from other law enforcement agencies and other government agencies that they can pull on. They also probably have access to license plate reader information. Right. So when they decide to target someone nowadays, can they pull up all of that stuff when they're targeting them for investigation?
Absolutely. And you know, with the Patriot Act and the amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, they're also gathering a lot of electronic data about us on a regular ongoing basis, again, without any suspicion that the individuals whose information they're gathering are doing anything wrong. And that just gives them this vast pool of information that they can use to target people that they don't like for selective prosecution.
Right,
so,
and if they were watching me, they could see maybe I went to a nearby pub that had been associated with anarchists because they could see that on my receipts, or they could see that on what I purchased. I know when I purchase certain things or when I go to certain doctors, I certainly start getting ads about that illness that nobody's supposed to know because of HIPAA laws, you know, but they know really quickly by the drugs that you buy, by the doctor you go to, that you have this disease or that disease. So it's worrisome when you think that they have all of that. So they could, like, have some interest in this person, pull up all this other stuff, and convince themselves there's more reason, or convince themselves there's not, I suppose. I'm betting it goes more one way than the other.
Right. I mean, one problem with the radicalization theory is there's no way out of what they call the funnel. So once they consider you radicalized, there's no cure for it.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm really glad there's no cure for radicalization.
Right.
I mean that completely differently, but
right, of course. Right, but basically that's what encourages this aggressive policing, and particularly there are a number of cases I talk about where it's selective policing, where the charges that they bring against people are things that they normally would not investigate, and they're only investigating because they believe this person has these bad ideas and therefore is part of the pool of people who may do something wrong in the future.
Yes.
But of course, if any of us could do something wrong in the future, we're all in that pool.
Well, yeah, I think it was the Stasi leader who said, "Show me the man, I'll show you the crime." He was
right,
the leader
exactly.
of the secret police, and he knew that he could find a crime one way or another with anybody if he
right.
wanted to. Let the audience in on this a little bit. For you out there in the listening world, this is Linda Olson Osterlund. I'm talking to Mike German. He's the author of a very compelling and really very readable, and even if you think you know it all, you're going to learn stuff in this book. It's Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy, which I think is really the key central point you make, that you show us in really many examples throughout the book. I also want to let the audience know that I'm going to open the phone lines in a few minutes, so you will be able to call in and ask your questions or make your comments. The number to dial is 503-231-8187, and that's if you want to talk to Mike German, the author, former FBI agent, and now really telling the truth in a very in-depth and evocative look at the FBI over the last many years, and it does take an even longer historical look than what we've been talking about, but I think this current period is one of the periods when the FBI has morphed into something different than what we expected. Mike, you talk about it being moved from law enforcement to will you talk about that, how it was a law enforcement agency, but now it's an intelligence agency?
Sure. Part of the issue was right after 9/11, the FBI hid what actually happened. They hid that these were poor management decisions regarding information that agents had collected in Minnesota. They'd collected information about Zacharias Moussaoui, French citizen who was attempting to get lessons to fly a jumbo jet without having the need to do that, didn't have any kind of job in aviation. There was an agent in Phoenix who had determined that the subjects of his Al-Qaeda investigations all had jobs in aviation. There were a number of different investigations that were sort of coming to a head, but that information just wasn't moving once it went into the system. And instead, what they presented was that they didn't have information, that this was an intelligence failure, and therefore they needed broad new powers like the Patriot Act and amending FISA. And in doing that, they put all this, turned the faucets on with the information coming in, but they hadn't fixed the management problems. And so, so now you had the same poor management structure, but with tremendously more information to mismanage. And what
They literally got backed up in information, didn't they? They couldn't even keep up with all the information they were collecting.
Absolutely. So when you look at cases where the FBI did investigate people like Nadal Hassan, who committed a mass shooting in Texas, after the shooting, the investigation found, they actually used the term a data explosion was happening within the FBI, and the agents were just so overwhelmed with the amount of information coming in that they couldn't find the critical pieces that were that could have helped them prevent the attack. There was a number of other people like that, the Boston Marathon bombers, who again had been under investigation, and even though the older brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was put on the watch list, and the watch list worked as designed, where it pinged when he bought a ticket to go to Russia, it pinged when he went to the airport to go to Russia, it pinged when he came back from Russia. Nobody responded to those alarms because there were so many people going through the system that the alarms were now meaningless.
Real potential terrorism moved forward. Real terrorism moved forward in the mass of that not being caught, and other cases where that were not really terrorists were getting attention as well, tons of attention as well, and so they weren't being able to.
But disconnecting from law enforcement, where you're focused on somebody breaking the law, into this broad area where somebody might in the future become a threat, the number of people just increases exponentially. And we live in a country where we're really lucky that there's very little terrorism, so it should be easy to focus the resources, as we did in my investigations, based on some indication of wrongdoing. But once they move into this intelligence gathering phase, really they're getting so much information, all they can do is profile, and they profile through the racial and ethnic mapping, which is a program at the FBI where they map American communities.
Let me hold you right there, because I think that's important. This mapping thing that they're doing is really important for us to talk about. But we've got a caller on the line, and I want to let them get in.
Sure.
Edie, good morning, Edie. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much for documenting this stuff. I've only had a college long. Your integrity. We need to hear it, and we need to read it, and we love that you document it. I think that the history of the FBI from the Pinkertons trying to attack unions, union organizing, and immigrants, people are trying to separate people, divide and conquer, so they don't unite for social change to make the world just and fair for everyone, is a long time pattern. And that pattern of evil always is hypocritical. It uses fear. So the double standard, the U.S. government spending so much money to radicalize people, if it's Afghans and Iraqis, if it is Muslims in other countries in here, radicalize them. But we're not even talking about how Fox and corporate media is trying to, onslaught of fear, hate, lies to radicalize people politically so they will justify dehumanizing and abusing and oppressing others. And that double standard, even the city of Portland and what the FBI go after and who they do not. The real terrorists, the real violent criminals, the criminal gangs of white supremacist racists, assaulting and battering with all this documentation that's put on video and on photographs.
Well, and
with
Edie,
Rosa the Antifa telling people what they do, but the police follow that.
Edie, Mike actually has some experience with that and also writes about that. Do you want to talk a little bit about the way that that's happened in this city? Them going after the wrong people.
Right. I mean, again, because this intelligence standard takes the focus off of actual wrongdoing and onto ideology, it's easy for law enforcement to target groups based on ideology rather than based on facts, and especially having in the 1990s been involved in investigations against neo-Nazis and anti-government militia groups that are engaged in violence. It really shocked me when I started to see these violent protests that weren't being policed.
Yes. You write very well about this, by the way, in the book. You do a really good job, I think, of laying out how they're basically, it was policing holding back and standing back and then attacking right. in the other cases.
Right, and especially that you know, side by side, at the very same time, we see how the police respond to a Black Lives Matter protest with militarized tactics and equipment and a very aggressive riot police out engaging in violence, and the same at Standing Rock, where you have protesters who might be engaged in some civil disobedience, but are not violent, they're not hurting people. And yet the responses to those two different kinds of events were completely opposite.
Well, and very expensive, I assume. Oops, sorry, we'll get that sound off right now. Are you there, Mike? Uh-oh. Somehow we lost Mike, I'm sorry. For the listeners, we will get Mike back on the line. I'll let our great engineer get that figured out and get Mike German back on the line. He's talking about, right then he was talking about the, you know, the disparity of response from certain kinds of, you know, crimes, corruption and white collar crimes and all sorts of other of those kind of crimes, but the overwhelming response when it's something like Standing Rock, he also talks extensively in the book about the Black Lives Matter movement and how it was targeted and how all of this comes out of this radicalization ideology and basically an ideology they've made up. Okay, hi, Mike. It's Linda.
Right. Yeah.
I was telling
them. Sorry about that.
Yeah, sorry about that. Whatever happened. I was telling them about, you know, how this targeting of Black Lives Matter and other groups like that came out of the theory and the ideology really inside the FBI that expects black people to be more dangerous and even has it in their trainings. And, you know, the same with Muslims, expects Muslims to somehow, because they are Muslim, be potential terrorists. But can you talk about that internal philosophy or theory that allows them to, you know, one, get fewer and fewer diverse agents and an atmosphere inside the agency itself that, you know, reflects, I think, racist views.
Right. And I document and talk to a number of agents who were targeted early after 9/11 because of their Muslim faith or their Middle Eastern backgrounds. I believe it's a product of this radicalization theory because it trains agents to believe that people's association or identification with certain ideas or groups is an indicator of dangerousness. So when the FBI is hiring agents, you know, and they look at somebody who looks like them, the FBI still remains overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male, they can look at little blemishes in their record and see themselves. You know, maybe they got in a little bit of minor scrapes when they were in college or high school. But when they're looking at somebody from a community they're not familiar with, it's easier to assume some sort of nefarious activity or to see that as somehow more dangerous.
And also,
therefore they get weeded out.
Yeah, and also you pointed out that from the top, they don't attempt to dispute that. They don't attempt to say, you know, they pretty much wanted to cement in this black extremist identity based in nothing, really. Manufactured that. We have a couple callers on the line, but I want to get back to that. Let's let the next caller on, who is Suzanne. Hi, Suzanne.
Yes.
Welcome.
Hi. Hi, I worked in a crime lab at Cal Berkeley. Our boss was great because he went you know, who, what, where, when, and why is the journalistic path. And he'd say, we're going to go backwards. And we'd sit down after we had looked at the evidence. We had a 90% solve rate. But boy, he put us through the paces. And he'd ask, he'd go around, what are you assuming right now about this case?
Wow.
And, yeah, you.
He wasn't going to let you just move right through it. He was going to make sure you questioned, huh?
And, we also had, so we go around on assumption and drop that. Then we go around, what, if any, skill do you feel you are missing that you don't have the training for in this particular case? So I think that what you're talking about and happening in FBI, there's such a rigidity, sounds like to me, that you can't really get very far with a car that doesn't have a battery. And the way we solved cases was quick, and we looked at every bit of evidence, but there was always something that was missing. So that would be the last question. What evidence is not even here? Because, and I won't talk any longer, I haven't watched TV for 8 years, and I do not have a gun. I love to, you know, investigate. And it was probably one of the most delightful jobs I've ever had. And thank you for your book, Mike. I'm going out to order it right now.
Well, great. Thank you, Suzanne.
Yeah. Okay. Have fun. Bye-bye.
Fine. And it is an enjoyable job. And, you know, I went to join the FBI because I wanted to serve my community and use my talents to help protect the community from real threats. And was fortunate that often in my career I was able to work those kinds of cases and was very invested in the types of processes that she was talking about, where you're trying to get to the truth,
yes.
Where once they move out of law enforcement and the FBI now says law enforcement is not its primary mission, its primary mission is national security, which is a lot muddier a concept. How do we protect national security? What does
that
mean?
Well, you know, they even put things like energy security as if, like,
right.
It's a right, like we have a right to energy security. That's a really interesting broad brush, isn't it? Because that could mean stopping another country because they're actually using their own oil that we want.
Right.
it could mean
a lot
of things, but...
Right. And often what it means is that they're looking on the horizon for what community might be a problem, and that's what started this racial and ethnic mapping program, where they made these very crass, prejudiced ideas about what types of crime different racial and ethnic populations engage in, and then went out and gathered census data to map every American community by race and ethnicity and track what they call ethnic behaviors, which when I was with the ACLU, we sued trying to get the list of behaviors that they were tracking.
I think this is a very important point. Think of them making maps of where different ethnic people shopped, where they live, and putting that map out there. And didn't they even talk about some of those areas being hunting zones?
Right.
For finding the, because they firmly believed that they were like where people of minorities or Muslims or foreigners lived were sort of like places that automatically grew up radicals. And somehow they separate it from the conditions of life. It's pretty interesting. We do have two more callers on the line, though, so
sure.
Let's get them on. Harry, you're next.
Oh, greetings, everyone, and thank you for taking my call. Right after the Iraqi war in 2003, I think it was, there was an attack against attorneys. It was a famous case. It was a Portland attorney that was accused of planting a bomb in Spain.
Right. I'm not going to think. Brandon Mayfield.
Yes. Right. Yes. And what happened to him? It was the FBI targeted him, even though it was international. But it put a chill across all the attorneys working in the United States, because they can arrest you for anything. I mean, plant something on you. And of course, eventually, it was proven. He didn't do it by fingerprints, but it was an FBI agent who did fingerprints, and they accused him. So was that do they set people up like that quite a bit?
That was an interesting case, and where Brandon's Muslim's beliefs were actually listed as one indicator of his more likely to have committed that crime. And so that was a perfect example of how this radicalization theory comes into reality and has a real impact in the world. And, of course, we've seen that come down not just from the federal government, but now into state and local law enforcement, where the NYPD, for example, had a Muslim mapping program. One of the problems that I identify in the book is that the FBI is often, as a leader in law enforcement, is teaching other police departments how to conduct their business, and unfortunately they're getting all the wrong messages, which is why I was so interested in coming to Portland to talk about how important it was to keep the Portland police under local control and make sure they were following local rules, and therefore staying out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
Okay, the next issue was the question I have is about the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. And it first started with against the banks. That's what the Occupy was against. Eventually, it spread out to different whatever. So, I know the FBI had quite a bit of surveillance against them. People who, because at the time, everyone was losing their jobs, they were losing their homes. You know, was this like a release right. mechanism, or to release pressure of the of society, or was it, what did the FBI do?
Can I jump in there too, Mike? I want to ask you a little bit about
sure.
that, because from my observations here, and I also did eventually get redacted conversations, emails, and conversations between Homeland Security. Head of Homeland Security's office and Portland's Fusion Center. But it certainly appeared to us that there were a series of clampdowns of closing Occupy sites, including here in Portland, that all said the same language of why they were closing, and leading up to it, they used the same language specifically about the dangers they said the camps were producing, and unsafe, and all of these different things. And it seemed to me that the response to those place cities that had actual occupations was a coordinated one from Homeland Security. Now, we know that Homeland Security was talking to different Occupy, to different fusion centers around the nations where there were camps, because those redacted emails were gotten by the I'm not going to say their name right now, because I'm not remembering it, but it's a civil liberties organization in New York City. Anyway, so do you mm-hmm. think that the FBI, like when we see Homeland Security jackets on police here, and we rarely see FBI jackets. Do you know what I mean? We
mm-hmm.
the face of the
right.
feds here is Homeland Security, but who would have been in on that kind of situation?
Well, certainly the FBI would have been involved in the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, and again using these same techniques that they had used to target Muslim Americans, where in the Occupy group in Ohio, in Cleveland, the FBI sent an informant in who rounded up some young men, and then in a month, and I think it even lasted almost a year, process encouraged them to commit a bombing and provided them with all the means necessary and actually provided them a place to live, because otherwise they would have broken up.
These were children, basically, who had been thrown out of the foster system or their own families. They were street children, young men. I remember reading about them.
And I used to counsel. They were not local, so this informant actually provided them a place to live free of charge so they would stay together.
Well, see, and I used to counsel families and kids who were runaways and that kind of situation. I mean, it makes me want to cry because it's cruel, because they use these children's need for parental approval and parental support and some place and way to live. And then put them all in jail. It's disgusting, actually.
Right, and provide them with weapons that were far beyond their abilities or financial resources to obtain, to make it look like they were far more dangerous than they ever could have been on their own.
When they were kids who had been damaged in our society, you know, kids that, you know, we kick kids out of foster care who had a really difficult life and don't have necessarily the education or skills to survive, and then we're going to do this to them when they show up at an event. Good work, FBI.
Right. And it puts the FBI in this strange position where they're the ones actually manufacturing terrorism cases and scaring the public. You know, there's a case in New York where they directed this group of people, offering them $250,000 to bomb a synagogue. The Christmas tree lighting ceremony manufactured bombing there in Portland, mm-hmm. to where the people who were attending those events and locations felt real fear.
Yes.
Because of something manufactured entirely by the FBI,
and
that place was not targeted by actual terrorists.
Yeah. And some of those people probably have post-traumatic stress from other things, and so it just doubled it up on them.
Portland, the publicity around this fake terrorist attack actually led to a real terrorist attack where there was an arson attack on a mosque.
Yes.
So because the FBI manufactured this case, it led to a real act of terrorism against the Muslim community. So it's just quite irresponsible, and I think continued to divide Americans along the lines that, as you said, right-wing media has been playing up for some time, and this radicalization theory reinforces that somehow there are these other American groups that aren't as American as we are,
right,
however defined. And you know, that those sorts of divisions, the FBI basically started increasing those divisions rather than restoring the...
And keeping the Muslim community in fear through it all. We have another caller on the line.
Sure.
Jack, welcome to KBOO. Are you there, Jack?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, it's connected now. Glad to hear that you're talking about this manufactured terrorism. I've heard from some analysts that virtually all, the terrorism in the U.S. is manufactured and ginned up, and it's an agenda, the agenda being the global war of terror, which is, we all know how serviceable that is. They can get a lot done with the global war of terror, and it goes way back. It's not just since 9/11. There is the WTC 93 bombing, mm-hmm. where there's so much evidence that shows clearly that that was an FBI operation. And I'm glad you're pointing this out. It needs to be in the forefront. I believe it needs to come out, and people have to start address it needs to be addressed seriously.
Yeah, I encourage you to get this book, or I'm assuming it's going to be in libraries really quickly as well, if that's another way for you to read it. It's got lots of details that you may not have heard before, and it lays out a really cogent the theory of radicalization and how internal to the FBI this has expanded to where now, one, there's way less diversity. There's many fewer agents of color and many fewer women agents. And what that means is that they don't have that point of view when they're going into these cases with this bad structure. It's really very damaging.
Yeah, my point being that it's actually intentional. It's just not accidental,
yeah.
And it's just not demographically an accident or overlooking inclusion of certain minorities and stuff. It's intentional. Could your
yes.
guest address that?
Sure.
So, you know, one of the things I learned as an investigator is that it's very hard to determine motive, and that many times when somebody is engaged in some kind of behavior, there are multiple motives, and determining what is the primary versus the secondary or the tertiary is often very difficult. I mean, I think it's a combination of things, and one most important to keep in mind is that the FBI is a microcosm of the United States. So obviously we've seen these divisions increasing among our neighbors and friends, and you know, the way I approach it in the book is to talk about how a law enforcement agency works to support the rule of law and the equal application of the law, but moving into this domestic intelligence mission and this national security mission, that gets scrapped in favor of determining who might become a future threat. And unfortunately, the FBI is not very good at that. Nobody's good at it. Nobody can determine what the future is. But when threats appeared on the horizon in 2004, there were FBI assistant director who led the white collar crime program who began publicly warning that the number of mortgage fraud cases they were seeing was rising rapidly and was going to cause serious harm to our economic structure if it wasn't addressed, and asked for more resources and was told no, not realizing that by 2008 it would become the number one national security crisis was the financial meltdown that was occurring not just in the United States but had ripple effects abroad. Similarly, when you look at what's currently embroiling our government, which is the foreign interference in U.S. elections, you know, that didn't happen from some country who had never posed a threat to the United States. Right? This was a country who, with all these expanded spying powers the government has, you think they'd be focused on it. But instead, the FBI was very late to understand what was going on, and frankly still doesn't quite understand what happened. And that is obviously something that is impacting all of us right now, and wasn't predicted with these great analytical tools that the FBI has gathered. So it's very easy for them to miss what's going on. And as we mentioned before, in the terrorism context, you know, far-right militants kill more people in the United States than any other type of group, and yet the FBI today can't even tell you how many white supremacists kill people in the United States each year. So it's a matter of not focusing on objective evidence of harm.
When it comes to the killings of policemen, also, that's one thing they really say, well, they need to watch out for these black extremists, black identity extremists, because they're killing policemen and they target policemen. But the statistics are actually the opposite, right?
Right, exactly. And you know, that was a fascinating report to read because it was number one, just poorly written from an English major's perspective. It really had serious problems, but just the analysis was so poor that it took six completely unrelated events over a three-year period and tried to manufacture a movement around it, not recognizing that, number one, the felonious assaults on police are actually very low right now. We're at record lows of the number of police officers being killed, so it was promoting this war on cops theory that actually isn't borne out by the evidence, number one. But number two was ignoring that far more police officers are killed by far-right extremists than or far-right militants than people from any other group, and yet that wasn't put in context in the report, so that you would imagine any police officer reading this would have been far more concerned about Black Lives Matter activists coming to their town than people who might pose a real threat to them.
Well, and it's just like here in Portland, how the real threat, the people who have started the violence, the people who even say they're bringing guns and bring rifles into demonstrations here, the Patriot Prayer, the Proud Boys, they get really overlooked. And only recently, and it's taken a lot of public pressure and pushback for them to start arresting some of the people on that side, whereas at almost every demonstration they would arrest people who went down to countermeasures. And certainly the new police chief made it clear that she had either been informed that which side to be on, or she already naturally stood on that side, because soon after she arrived in town, she went on right-wing radio and said that we, the counter-protesters, were whining about getting our butts kicked by her, by the police. So she clearly has an idea of policing that's kind of reversed. But I think that happens around the nation. We find these links between the police and the right-wing militias and people who, you know, who have that right-wing outlook. And to some degree, they think of themselves as natural allies.
Doesn't that go further to supporting the idea that most of this stuff is by agents provocateurs, and this is instigated and this is intentional, that the intent is to sow discord?
Well, yes.
Yeah, I mean,
I think there's always informants in the mix.
Yeah, well, we're talking about agents provocateurs, people that are going to go out and instigate violence.
Yeah, I've seen guys at an otherwise peaceful demonstration, all of a sudden light a sparkler and throw it in a garbage can. I don't trust that they're doing that for good reasons. I think they're doing that to draw the attention of the police.
Well, I think they're doing it to make a riot, to create a riot.
Yeah, yeah. When you draw the attention of the police, you get trouble, is what I'm saying. Yes, I agree with you on that. But I don't know if that's always the goal of the FBI. Or we don't see the FBI. We see Homeland Security here. Mike, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, particularly with the riots in Portland, a lot of them are organized by people out of state. And so you would imagine that the FBI would be prominent in, again, we built all these information sharing platforms, whether it's the Joint Terrorism Task Force or the Fusion Centers, that the information would flow very easily about what's going on here, and it would be a federal investigation. But we don't see that when it involves these far right militants, and I find that a problem, because again, when I worked this in the 1990s, it was much more clear that the police understood how those groups operated, and that seems to have been intelligence lost.
Yes, we have one more caller. I'm going to see if they can do it really quick. Hi, Paul. Hi, Paul.
Thanks for the call. I was just reflecting, and you may have touched on this before I was actually listening, but the whole Muhammad situation back at the tree lighting ceremony in 2010.
Yes.
I was coming down from zoo lights on the Max for that evening, and I just remember reflecting on what insanity reading about it was the next day, that here's this provocateur situation with the whole, young, easily influenced, I think is he Somali?
He was 17 or something when they first started talking with him, He was a young guy who was disenfranchised. He was having some troubles, but they targeted him and used him. Well, thank you for that. I'm going to let you go because that is what we were going to talk. We already did talk about that, and I want to give Mike the last say.
Thanks again for having me, and thanks for all your callers for great questions. I tried in the book to explain, rather than just list a bunch of incidents where the FBI did something wrong, but rather explain what underlies that and the foundational problems that go back throughout the history of the FBI, but also the resurrection of these flawed concepts.
Well, and the links and the information about Mueller and his role in the FBI over time and Comey, you don't separate that out because they were part of it all this time. And I got a lot more information than I had there before. So I really appreciate that.
Great. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so I encourage people to tune in, check the book out, get it from your library, or get it and share with other people. The last few paragraphs about what it would take to actually change an FBI, I thought were very good. So we didn't get to that. We didn't get to talk about that this time. But you, the listener, can get the book and listen to it that way. Thanks again, Mike German. I'm sure we'll have you on again sometime in the future. And thank you for your book. I just put away my paper, so I couldn't say the name again. I want to say the name of your book again. One more.
Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide.
That's right. Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide. How the New FBI Destroys America's Democracy.
Damages
democracy. I got to say destroy instead. I made it firmer.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you very much. And I thank all of our audience and our calling in, our listeners who called in. I also thank John Shuck, our wonderful engineer who facilitates all this. And stay tuned for Teresa Mitchell and Press Watch.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
This is KBOO Portland. It is 9 o'clock and Press Watch is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech on Monday, November 18th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Northwest Academy in Portland. Cyrus Farivar, author of the book Hobbyist Data, will speak on legal and privacy history and what our rights are currently, and how law enforcement agencies and companies can collect and use our private details, often without our knowledge. Again, that's Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech with Cyrus Farivar on Monday, November 18th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Northwest Academy, 1130 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.